Yes, we promised you the special guest here on World Football Daily. I think Rafa gave a little hint away in a moment ago, just before that quick break. But he is on the line joining us now, Mr. Tim Vickery, to talk all things South American football, joining us here on World Football Daily. Tim, how are you, mate? First appearance of 2013. You're not rusty, are you?
Yeah, I don't know who your very special guest is, but before he comes along, you've got to have to put up with me.
Always a pleasure, always a pleasure. I'm sure we can bear with you for 15 minutes or so, mate. It's we're well into the Copa Libertadores, some groups with three games played already in it, Tim. But the big story, of course, has been off the pitch in the Copa Libs so far, with the incident at Corinthians, with the young fan who died during that Corinthians-San Jose game. What has been the reaction in Brazilian football and South American and football in general?
Well, it's been a hectic few days since the tragic death of Kevin Beltran, 14-year-old Bolivian. It's always so affecting when you have someone so young who goes on to a football match and doesn't go home afterwards. Corinthians punished with for the time being, they have to play their games in the competition behind closed doors. I have to say that there was some early reaction in the club that I thought was very disappointing, where Corinthians internally were debating pulling out of the Libertadores in protest at this punishment. And I think that was a very, very unwise position. Yes, Corinthians are not the only ones to blame. And these are the lessons that were learnt the hard way with the number of deaths on industrial scale in Europe, with Bradford and Heysel and Hillsborough, that it's not usually hooliganism that is the only killer. There are also basics such as stadium infrastructure and crowd control operations, and it's clear that in this case in San Jose, certainly the search of supporters on the way in was not adequate. But the flare that killed Kevin Beltran clearly came from Corinthians supporters. And so the club have to take some level of responsibility for the action of their own supporters. So I thought it was absurd, the idea being cogitated inside Corinthians of pulling out of the competition in protest. And thankfully, wiser counsel prevailed, and that's no longer the position of Corinthians. It was an eerie game last night that they played. Four supporters managed to take out a legal action and win their right to enter the stadium. So there were four supporters. Apart from that, it was the atmosphere of a training game. You could hear everything that the coaches were saying. And that we can only hope in the long term that it leads to a better culture of health, safety, crowd control in South American stadiums. We had the incident in the qualifying rounds of the Libertadores. You might remember it was Grêmio at home in their new stadium against Liga of Quito, LDU of Quito. And that I thought was an emblematic incident because Grêmio just moved to this new stadium. And it's a traditional part of Grêmio that when they score a goal, it's what's called the avalanche. It's fans running towards, fans behind the goal, running towards the edge of the stands there, where the stands meet the pitch. And when Grêmio built their new stadium, they were anxious to preserve this part of their culture. So it was an all-seater stadium, with the exception of an area behind one of the goals, where there was a space for standing specifically to preserve this avalanche. But what no one seemed to have thought of, and I think this is fairly worrying that no one had thought of it before, is that the modern stadium, the new stadium, the slope of the stands is much, much steeper. Now, the contemporary conception of a stadium is that the slope is much steeper in order to get as many of the fans as close to the pitch as possible. Before the old stadiums, you know, where Grêmio used to do their avalanche, the slope was much less steep. So it was one thing to have that avalanche in the old stadium, and as it turned out, quite another to have it in the new stadium, because with the much steeper slope, that avalanche became dangerous. The crash barriers buckled, eight people injured, only by fortune, none of them seriously injured. So that avalanche has now gone. There will be seats put in that area, and so that's the end of that particular culture, which is, I think, emblematic, because it does show, it's a lesson that supporters in England and elsewhere have learnt, that the new stadiums, there is a price to pay for this, quite apart from rising ticket prices, but the price to be paid for better comfort is sometimes reduced atmosphere. And that will clearly be the case with the end of this Gremio avalanche, because in the new stadium, it simply isn't safe.
Tim, are you a proponent of, I mean, because South American football, so much of that culture is what happens in the stands with the choreography, the ticker tapes, the flares, etc. Do you want to see this taken away? Do you want to see it controlled better? What's the step forward for this sort of antics and maybe keeping that flavour in South American football?
Yeah, well, I'm a little bit once bitten, twice shy on this. As you know, anyone of my age, and I'm 47, so I'm old enough to have lived through the changes in English football. And I'm sure you've read the book Fever Pitch.
Yeah.
One of the most outstanding parts in that book for me is Nick Hornby, who wrote the book Arsenal Fan, it's a book about his life supporting Arsenal, reflecting post-Hillsborough, reflecting on the number of times that it could have happened to him. And that there's one game specifically that he mentions. It was Arsenal against Southampton in 1980. Just by coincidence, I was there. And it seems funny to think of it now, but Southampton were the biggest draw in English football at the time, almost. It was Arsenal's first home game of the season. I'm not an Arsenal fan, but I'm a football fan, first and foremost, and I wanted to see the game. Kevin Keegan, the big superstar of English football at the time, playing his first game in London since coming back from football in Germany. So, as I said, Arsenal's first home game of the season. It was a midweek evening game. There was a huge crowd, and I was caught in that same crush there as Nick Hornby. And as a little 15-year-old kid, there were times in there where I thought I was in serious problems. I think all of us of that certain age, I think we kind of look back after Hillsborough, and we dwelt on the number of times that it could have happened. In my wanderings around South America, I've seen so many occasions where, you know, bad crowd control could easily lead to a tragedy. And the lesson is that, you know, it only needs to go wrong once. And I was thinking the other day about the famous one at the Ibrox Stadium in Glasgow, the disaster there, where I think 66 people died. There's always been a story that Rangers scored a late goal, so some people who were leaving the stadium came back and met and formed a crush with people who were leaving the stadium at the end of the game. Apparently, none of that is true at all. It was purely the steps, huge steps, taking thousands out of the ground. The steps were so steep that all it took was a few people to slip, and you got people then piling up on top of each other. And so it was so banal. There wasn't actually one specific factor like a late goal for the home side. It was something that could have happened at any time. I'm old enough to remember how the lessons of Heysel in 85 were not learned. Now, the lesson of Heysel, it was the final of the European Cup between Liverpool of England and Juventus of Italy. Mm. And all of the blame afterwards was placed on Liverpool fans, who on three occasions charged across to where some Juventus fans were standing. No one died as a result of conflict between the fans. It was panic that killed those people trying to flee from the Liverpool fans, and clearly the action of the Liverpool fans was crucial to the death of 39 people. But there were three other factors, without those three other factors, there wouldn't have been any loss of life. And those three other factors were a stadium which was in a deplorable state of maintenance, and no one was doing any maintenance because it was the last game in that stadium, a system of ticket distribution that Liverpool had been implored, had begged UEFA not to play the game in that stadium and not to play the game with a system of ticket distribution which would inevitably lead to supporters of Juventus being next to supporters of Liverpool, and a police operation that was totally, totally inadequate. It was clear that there was need for more reinforcement in this space between Liverpool fans and some Italians, and the police operation was so negligent that their walkie-talkie radios didn't even have batteries. So all of the focus afterwards was on the hooliganism. And that made people forget perhaps the most important truth about football crowds, which is the mere quantity of that amount of people together in a reduced space in itself represents a threat to the safety of those people. So if loss of atmosphere is a price to pay for increased safety, I'm quite happy to pay it. I understand, especially in Argentina, the atmosphere in Argentine stadiums is absolutely magnificent. It's a wonderful thing. But if some of that has to be sacrificed in order for everyone to go home safely at the end of the game, then that's a price well worth paying.
Of course, and nobody wants to see anything like the previous disasters or even the recent ones taking place in the stands of football grounds again, Tim. When we look at what's been happening on the pitch in Copa Libertadores, Corinthians, as you say, with that very comfortable win last night against Millonarios in the empty stadium. What about this matchup between Iquique and Emelec? I hope I'm saying those right there, Tim. Incredible win for Iquique in their first ever Copa Libertadores competition.
Yeah, and they'd lost their first two. So it was kind of win or bust, and they managed to win. But really, looking at the big picture, it's been an extraordinary Libertadores so far. It's been a Libertadores where I think it's so hard to find a pattern. And there's usually a statistic that you can usually count on in the Libertadores, which is that for every one away win, for every one win by the road team, there are three home wins. You can usually count on that. It's a very high ratio because in South America, you know, there are long journeys for the away team. There are temperature differences, there are conditions such as altitude, intimidating atmospheres in the stadium. And usually the home team has a much bigger advantage in South America than it does in Europe's Champions League, for example. But this year, and so far, we've had 14 home wins and 15 away wins. It's almost inexplicable. And it's been a Libertadores full of very unpredictable results. And Huachipato of Chile winning away at Gremio of Brazil. It's an extraordinary result, given the absolute financial chasm between these two clubs and the fact that Huachipato won the Chilean championship for only the second time, but then had to sell some of their best players while Gremio have been on a mad shopping spree. So there's just a chasm between these two sides. And Huachipato won a deserved victory. From Peru, Real Garcilaso. They're a side less than 5 years of existence that reached the final of the Peruvian Championship in December, lost in that. Since then, it's a very, very different team. And we thought that their only real advantage in this year's Libertadores would be the extreme altitude of Cusco, where they play their games. They played one there and they managed to get a draw. But they've won two away games against difficult opponents, Cerro Porteño of Paraguay and now Tolima of Colombia. Difficult places to go. But with blanket defence and a late breakout goal, they've managed to win those two games 1-0. So that's a sensational performance and totally, totally unpredictable. And the Libertadores has been full of that this year. It's panning out as an absolutely fascinating competition. Although I think in the last couple of days, we're beginning to see the quality come through. You mentioned Corinthians there, who looked very impressive against Millonarios. Atlético Mineiro of Brazil winning 5-2 away to Arsenal of Argentina with that combination that was so effective in the Brazilian Championship last year. The passing ability of Ronaldinho and the pace of Bernard, who cuts in from the flank, especially from the left flank, and he scored three of those goals. They tore the defence of Arsenal to shreds. So we're beginning to see the quality of the top Brazilian sides coming through. But as I say, it's been fascinating and unpredictable and well worth watching this year, the Libertadores.
Arsenal playing like their English counterparts there, maybe. Tim, there's been a build-up into this Copa Libertadores about the strength of these Brazilian sides because of the financial spending power that they have over a lot of the other South American sides. Does this bode well for Copa Libertadores football? Do you think there's going to be an almost inevitability start to build up that's going to be dominated by the Brazilian clubs over the next few years?
I fear so, which is why I absolutely loved that result there with Grêmio losing at home to Huachipato, because according to logic, it just couldn't possibly happen, and it did, and it was great, it was wonderful. It's one of those things that kind of reinforces your faith in football. But no doubt about it, long term, this is a real concern for the Libertadores. And there were years, and because Argentine clubs still have a lead in the number of title wins, And there were years when there weren't even Brazilian clubs participating in the Libertadores in the late 60s. It only really started to get priority in Brazil from the early 90s when São Paulo won it a couple of times in style. And that put the competition on a new level in Brazilian minds. And it's now the priority in Brazilian club competition as well as Argentina. Over the last 21 years, there have only been three times when the final hasn't involved a Brazilian club. Argentina, meanwhile, is really the Argentine clubs. There's five of them in the competition, and even though we've had two and a bit weeks, all five of them have already lost a game. In fact, combined, the Argentine clubs have played 10 games, 4 victories and 6 defeats. And if you look in recent years, Argentina's record, although they've still been winning titles, it's not been particularly good. It's been very dependent on Boca Juniors of Riquelme. There was two or three years when Verón was magnificent for Estudiantes, and Vélez Sarsfield are a well-administered club. Last year was the first time since 2006 when there were two Argentine sides in the last eight, which is an extraordinary statistic, bearing in mind the historical strength of Argentina in the competition. I did a TV program the other day with a journalist who works in Porto Alegre in the south of Brazil, where the Argentine playmaker D'Alessandro plays for Internacional, who are not in this year's competition. But D'Alessandro apparently has been saying that his fear is that with the investments for the World Cup, the financial chasm between Brazil and Argentina, I suppose between Brazil and the rest of the continent, is going to grow even wider. And D'Alessandro was saying apparently that he'd love to go back and play for Argentina, but he would have to earn less than half than what he currently earns within Internacional. So I think there is a long-term problem for the Libertadores in terms of Brazilian domination. Now, football is so fascinating, and that there are so many components to football that money doesn't dictate totally. There are also tactical factors. And 2 years ago, when Santos won the Libertadores, it was when this financial chasm was really beginning to open up. And although Santos won the Libertadores, they were the only Brazilian club to get through to the last eight that year. And they very nearly fell before reaching the last eight as well. They needed some considerable good fortune to get past America of Mexico. And what was apparent then that year was that tactically, some of the sides from elsewhere in the continent were better, especially attacking the Brazilian teams with strikers in wide areas of the field. And the Brazilian clubs who were dependent on attacking fullbacks, this proved a real problem. Those attacking fullbacks, their forward runs were blocked and their defensive deficiencies were exposed. And so the teams from elsewhere in the continent were able to overcome Brazilian opposition despite the enormous financial difference between them. So there are tactical factors in play as well. And the nature of the Libertadores is that the wins are usually hard fought once you get into the closing stages of the competition. But clearly, too much Brazilian domination is not a good thing for the long-term health of the competition.
Well, let's hope it continues to serve up as many surprises as it has done in the early stages this season so far. Tim, it's been an absolute pleasure to have you back on the show. It's a shame we only have about 15 to 20 minutes with you every time we get you on. We could easily just give you an hour-long show and let you run with it yourself, mate. But we will look forward to getting you back on as the Copa Lib continues. And, of course, as South American football continues in general, we've also got the World Cup qualifiers still to come, which are still entertaining us thoroughly.
That's right. Yeah, it's the most competitive World Cup qualification campaign on the planet, and it resumes in less than a month's time. So let's kick the ball around in a few weeks on that subject.
We'll hold you to that, my friend. We will definitely hold you to that. Thank you so much for joining us, mate, and have a fantastic rest of your day, man.
Cheers. Thanks a lot. My pleasure.
Tim Vickery there of the BBC, South American football journalist, joining us here on World Football Daily. Surely, really, the South American football journalist on the planet when it comes to talking about everything going on in Copa Lib, of course, with the South American World Cup qualifiers as well. Interesting there, talking about the financial kind of aspects of South American football and the rise of Brazil as a financial power in world football. We were talking about that at the beginning of the season, how they were attracting players like Seedorf, like Forlan. Pato's obviously gone back there to Corinthians now as well. They had that fantastic win, as I say, last night in the empty stadium against Millonarios, and how that could be kind of detrimental to South American football in Copa Libertadores terms. Raf, though, we've seen a fair bit of money going into Mexican football recently as well. Do you think there's an opportunity with maybe some of the other leagues struggling to fund as well as maybe Brazil and possibly as Mexico as well? Is this a chance for Mexico to really start embedding itself in kind of Copa Lib football and challenging, you know, the Argentinian powerhouses, the Brazilian powerhouses, etc.?
You know what, Juice? I do feel like Mexico and Liga MX and, you know, the top flight of Mexican football is really kind of stepping up, and it's really, you know, starting to deliver and gain a little more recognition worldwide. I do think, you know, especially with Toluca and Tijuana, you know, showing up and having some decent games thus far in the Copa Lib, that yeah, it does kind of prove that Mexico might be able to kind of start maybe, I don't know, throwing a little bit more weight around on a global scale, man. I'm sorry, Juice. I'm sitting here thinking, like, as you asked four questions, and we got like 20 minutes worth with Tim Vickery. I mean, I almost, somebody who was really, really smart would have gone and kind of taken all of our Tim Vickery, like, interviews, spliced them up, and created some just massive, massive, like, South American football documentary, you know what I mean? Like, just put his words to, like, to film and whole old school highlights, and you'll get, like, the best fairy tale worth of videography in the world, man. I just love listening to Tim Vickery's voice. He does such a great job explaining everything completely. He doesn't answer questions. He gives dissertations, you know, with every single kind of discussion point that you bring up, Juice.
It's,
I mean,
the story behind the story that Tim brings you, which is just always, I mean, like, we're talking about, you know, crowd control in South America. We go back to a story of him being involved in, you know, in some horrific times in English football and European football, and going back.
He ties so much together. Right. He ties so much together and so many different kind of viewpoints and perspectives. You know, he literally does bring the world together with his discussion, and he makes it pertinent to you. You know, here's the world of South American football, and here's why it means something to you. Incredible stuff. I love Tim Vickery. Thank you, Tim, for coming on our show.
Rafa's Man Crush continues on the Main Man Down, covering South American football for the BBC and pretty much anybody else, because everybody will take his work. Tim Vickery joining us here on World Football Daily on the Thursday show. We're going to take a final quick break when we return. Raf, I want to get your thoughts on some of these MLS kits that seem to be flying around. Seattle Sounders released theirs yesterday, as did SKC and a few others. Let's have a look and discuss who's looking the best as we get ready for the start of the Major League Soccer season.